Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Today's show comes with a bit of a disclaimer. And I want to make sure that everybody out there knows this ahead of time. There may be some language on today's show that might not be appropriate, you know, for the little ones. But what Sean and I are going to try to do on today's show is bring everyone together under the banner of
Fuck Your Civility!
For 20 years, our rents have been going up, healthcare's been getting more expensive, and our incomes are staying the same. Not all Democrats are the same, and I am proud to be the only Democrat in this race that rejects all corporate money and champions and advances improved and expanded Medicare for all, a federal jobs guarantee, tuition-free public college, and the abolition of ICE. Now, I am proud to have inspired many of adaptations in this race, but what I think is really important is that in a district that is 85% Democrat, overwhelmingly working class, and 70% people of color, we deserve a working class champion.
It's Wednesday, June 27th, 2018. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. Coming off a week of throwing children in prisons, today we get to talk about civility, oh, and the great red wave coming in 2018. And I'm not talking Republican red, I'm talking socialist red. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week I talk to our Capitol muckraker, Inchi, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. On today's show, fuck your civility. That is our organizing principle in today's podcast. We're changing it up a little bit. We're going to carry that theme through the whole show, so strap in. Maxine Waters calls out demonstrators to harass the president and his administration members wherever they go. What does that earn her? Well, for the movement, they've rediscovered Maxine Waters. For Chuck and Nancy, it means that Maxine, how dare you? Oh, my God. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was kicked out of a restaurant. Please let them go eat in peace. By the way, if you're trying to get a reservation at the Red Hen where she was kicked out of, they're booked for the next month. Arnie Duncan compares Sarah Huckabee Sanders being denied a meal to Jim Crow. I can't make this up. And John Misek, Pennsylvania's own, joins the call by civility by retweeting someone who made millions getting people who believe in death panels and that Barack Obama was a Muslim into the Pennsylvania General Assembly. Hi, John. In segment two, we got to talk about the huge win last night in the New York primaries. The New York 17th House District, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who we've been talking about on this program, defeats Joe Crowley, you know, some random white dude. Now, actually, the fourth most powerful Democrat in yesterday's primary. And hey, by the way, Associated Press, she has a name. Ocasio-Cortez. We'll get into that a little bit. Ocasio-Cortez wasn't the only huge victory last night. Ben Jealous, amazing, huge win in the Democratic primary for a Maryland governor yesterday. We'll talk about the meaning of that. There were some other races across the country where progressives and left and DSA-backed candidates also got in the mix. Fantastic. And then back on the way down on the roller coaster of today's show, today's Supreme Court, the Supreme Court, SCOTUS, yes, upholds Trump's Muslim travel ban. That's good, right? And right before we started recording today, the Janice Viasmi case came down, 5-4 decision, and will have the effect of striking a major blow to public sector labor unions. Hey, labor movement, everybody out there, brothers and sisters, Time to break out your copy of Jane McAlevey's No Shortcuts and re-up your subscription to Labor Notes, because we got to go back to the militants that brought us what we got in the first place. Oh, and by the way, say it with me, everybody. Elections have consequences. I don't know what we're going to talk about in today's last call. Probably more of the same, because we're both on fire on this one. So I'm just going to switch right to remind everybody that yours truly, Kevin Mahoney from Raging Chicken Press, is teaming up with Colleen Fitzgerald from A Home Stony Run to bring you a new podcast called Free Range. Free Range is focused on food, politics, and communities of resistance, communities as resistance, communities that can be civil to one another while they're uncivil to the people who are bringing about the fascism that is upon us. What a better way to ground our political organizing in the very ground we walk upon, the people, the places, the process of sustenance and resistance. We'll be posting all our show updates and information about the project to our Facebook page. Just look for Free Range Podcast, or just Free Range on Facebook. Be sure to like us. Our first episode was posted, what, last week, 2 weeks ago? And we've got more stuff on the way. I want to remind everybody to tune into the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Look, and frankly, now more than ever, you got to be tuning into the Rick Smith Show every day at the ricksmithshow.com to listen to his daily radio show. Right, and make sure you get on Free Speech TV, because Rick has been on the Janus case for so long. Rick has been the voice of working class movement for so long, and we need to be supporting Rick Smith, right, and other folks that are bringing out kind of left media in this time. If we want a progressive future, look, folks, we need progressive media. Bottom line. You can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. If you're not ready to become a member, no problem. Just go to ragingchickenpress.org and click on that big blue donate button on the right sidebar. Drop us $500. That'd be awesome. Because we're going to need it now, folks. More than ever, like I said. But I'll tell you, with the 2018 midterm elections right around the way, a president and administration that's throwing kids into kind of internment camps, and now a gutting of kind of more of our civil rights, at the same time you've got a bunch of freaks calling for civility, guess what? Now is the time that we need you to become members of Raging Chicken Press so that we can continue the rage, right, and bring to you what we've been doing since we started in 2011. And next week, by the way, it's 7 years, guys. 7 years, everybody, that we have been here, Raging Chicken Press. Go to patreon.com as a part of our 7-year anniversary. Become a member today for as little $5 a month. patreon.com/rcpress. Well, there we have it, Sean. Happy Civility Week, I guess.
Yeah, you know, in a week of shitty hot takes, I don't know where we should start off.
How about this? I got an idea. So, because I'm really pissed off, it's weird. I was really pissed off until last night, and then last night was like this wave of elation, and then today it's like a return to, like, on the one hand, watching the direction of the growth of progressive left politics in this country, at the same time, the liberal class is treading water, right? Trying to say, no, we can't do that. Trying to guard civility as the only thing that they have, like, in their little hopper to guard on. And the right kind of basically, you know, keeps on doing what they're doing.
Yeah. You know, I feel like Will Bunch wrote an article yesterday, opinion piece, like, bleep your civility or bleep civility.
Yeah.
And pretty much, like, you know, like, we had the title of this podcast ready since, like, Tuesday or Monday when this whole civility debate really, like, blew up. And, you know, like, this week, you know, like, we're talking about, like, people who are setting up internment camps along the border,
right,
who want to put immigrant families indefinitely in camps, who want to split children apart, who'll probably never see their parents again because there is no, like, system in place to reunite these families. And somehow we have to be civil about this.
Right.
Like, we have to be civil about this because Sarah Huckabee Sanders didn't get served a meal at a restaurant, or because Elaine Chao, I think, is Mitch McConnell's wife, you know, gets confronted a bit with the audio of like the screaming, the crying, the wailing babies, children from these from these like these detention centers, like or the or just go down the list where, you know, someone calls Stephen Miller a fascist in a restaurant and chases him out, or Pam Bondi, who gets ran out of a movie theater because she doesn't want to defend people who need health care.
Right.
You know, like these people who are in suits and go after people are doing this in a civil way. But when we start yelling at these people and screaming and bird dogging them and yelling shame on you, apparently we're the ones being uncivil. I guess what we should do, right, with all this, we should just write nicely worded letters to the editor and debate these things in the editorial pages. I think that's like our only option that's left. Be kind and civil about it, and maybe they'll read our letters to the editors and reconsider their opinions.
Right. Well, Sean, I mean, you know, history has proven that that is what has gotten the goods in the past, right?
Yeah.
Letters just, to the editor.
Yeah. Just write a letter to the editor, and and maybe the people in power will listen to you, or maybe that editor of that newspaper will choose to publish that letter. If they so do so, and maybe we can then change our nation's discourse that way, because
here's what happened, Sean. Let me break it down for you. This is the model, right? This is the model. You write your letter to the editor, right? And then magic happens. It spreads from individual to individual who read this, and then they share it on social media, and their minds decide to like awaken and become enlightened. And then they decide that, oh my gosh, why have we been doing this the way it is before? Right. And then everything's better. Right. Isn't that what happens? Isn't that what enlightenment is all about? I mean, didn't Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. write a letter to the Birmingham while he was in Birmingham jail? And he wrote a letter, and that's what brought us the civil rights movement? Come on.
Yeah. I mean, the strategies that we're seeing, the strategies and tactics that we're seeing, and the people that are freaking out because they're uncomfortable about what they've seen, like these actions work. Right. Yes. It might be like out of catharsis rage that people are doing this, and it probably feels good getting this off their chest. But you know what? Shaming these people in public, chasing them out of a restaurant, making sure Kristen Nielsen, the head person of DHS, can't eat in a Mexican restaurant as she is detaining Mexican children and splitting Mexican children and Mexican families apart from these war-torn or Latino families apart from these war-torn, ravaged countries. Shame on us. Shame on us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
I mean, these people, these people have one place to go, and that is back to their gated communities. And we must force them back there. Like, should Corey Lewandowski or these people, like, after this whole administration, like, should they just go back to academia? Like, should Corey Lewandowski be at the Harvard, like, School of Politics right now as a fellow? He is in a well-respected position. I mean, that's where civility takes us, you know, mm-hmm. giving these people power after, you know, they fuck everything up.
That's right.
Like this is that this is where civility has brought us. And like, if you're uncomfortable about these actions, about people doing these actions, good. Like, this is Saul Alinsky type tactics.
Well, look, this is the fact is that we've got to understand, we have to be able to make distinctions. All right. And this is so important. Right. The thing is, and we were talking about this before we started recording today. Right. The idea, this call for civility, when they see that this is the problem. Right. They see Sarah Huckabee Sanders has been denied access to a restaurant. Right. That she's been. And then they see, like, you know, other members of the Trump administration kind of getting shamed and as when they're going out to eat and things like this. And then
or
you have
the audio of the children's crying in front of their house.
Right.
Or confronting members of Congress with that.
Right. And then you have all this pearl clutching that goes on, like, oh, my, I can't believe they're doing that. Like, and the only thing that I could think of at this point is that those people that are responding in that way are saying, like, oh, my God, what if somebody did that to me? Right. Or something along these lines, like this whole idea of putting themselves in their shoes. Now, look, I agree. If you're saying, you know, like I said, I've got family members, right? I have family members who are right wing folks.
right, who are pro-Trumpers and all this other kind of stuff, right? I have a relationship with those people, right? And we argue about stuff. We might even get heated at some point, but I'm still maintaining that relationship, right? I mean, still, I still have maintained it, right? And I can recognize this person as, like, the person that they are, complex and all this stuff. I have a history with them and all that kind of stuff. I have neighbors who I might disagree with, right? And we can discuss this stuff. We can argue about this stuff. And I don't need to kind of, like, stand outside their house, right, and just and kind of like I don't know, shine floodlights in their house all night long because I disagree with their opinion. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the authors of proto-fascism in this country. We're talking about the most powerful people on the planet who have their fingers on our military might, on our police system, who are throwing children in cages. We're saying those people have abdicated their rights. Those people have given up on civil society. Right. And so our response can't, like, you know, be like, hey, everything's OK. You know, I wrote, you
like,
know,
like where was the civility arguments for civility when like a thousands of white nationalists were marching through Charlottesville last summer? I don't remember calls for civility after that. I don't remember calls for civility when Trump was making fun of a disabled journalist in a crowd or telling people to beat up protesters. I don't remember the calls for civility. Now we're having this civility debate because the left is responding. Now listen, this is confrontational politics, but it's also, they're doing it in a harmless manner too,
right? It's confrontational, it's uncomfortable, right? It's uncomfortable, and it does break a certain pattern of how we want our lives to be. Look, what it means to be in a civil society is mean that we, yes, we have this degree of respect. We have this degree of saying, like, we may disagree with stuff like stuff, but we're going to kind of play at least within the same sets of rules for the most part, right? The right wing in this country has jettisoned those rules for a long time now.
Like 4 decades now, five decades.
Well, totally. But they've engineered it. It's like they put billions of dollars behind engineering exactly what we're seeing here today.
Let's
remember what happened during the Obama administration. Let's remember that, you know, you had people that out there, what they were showing up when, like, you know, you had pro-Obama rallies or something, like they were showing up with AR-15s. And those people still do. They are threatening people. They're threatening
people. You had a Supreme Court member calling Obama a liar.
Exactly. You're talking about that. And, like, you know, those are kind of like big deals. Right. Those were kind of big deals. And we were having this to say the same exact debate then. Right. When people on the left began getting pissed off and wanted to kind of start fighting back, what you saw once again is this return, this kind of like these liberals come out of the woodwork and start kind of like defending civility. Right. And they kind of defend civility. Right. In order not to stop the repression. Right. But to kind of say to the left, you stay in your place. We're the ones who get to define what is acceptable discourse on the left, not socialists, God forbid, right? Not activists, God forbid, but the established professional class that the Democratic Party has put its weight behind, all right, right, ever since, like, what, 1970s, right? And I'll tell you, I want to read something here. Like, so I wrote this article for, this is Collection. This is actually be coming out in November. I swear to God, I wish this was coming out now. I wrote this. I'm sorry. I wrote this article. It's called We Are Not. Hear that? We are not all in this together. A case for advocacy, factionalism, and making the political personal. Right. And it's for this collection called Unruly Rhetorics, which will come out the University of Pittsburgh Press in November. I've actually had to update this article a few times. It's been going through kind of revisions and kind of, you know, trying to land the publisher and stuff like this. It's a fantastic collection. The editors are Jonathan Alexander, Susan Jarrett, Nancy Welsh. Anyways, this is the epigraph I begin this with, right? Quote, today, tolerance appears again as what it was at its origins, at the beginning of the modern period, a partisan goal, a subversive, liberating notion and practice. Conversely, what is proclaimed and practiced as tolerance today is, in many of its most effective manifestations, serving the cause of oppression. That was Herbert Marcuse in an article called Repressive Tolerance in 1968. This is a dynamic that has been going on for a long period of time when civility is used as an excuse, right, to squash down any kind of militant response to oppression and exploitation.
Yes. And the people that are calling for civility, like Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, like these are people who are, it's sort of like if you have $10 million in your bank account, you're hanging out with people who have $10 million in your bank account, right?
That's right.
And you, this is the same thing. These are the social circles. Even though like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer might disagree with Donald Trump, they still hang out in the same country clubs, in the same, at the same pool parties, at the same social functions as Donald Trump's like people, like the people of his ilk. These are the, and this is why they are trying to stop. They're putting up the floodgates for this call on these calls for civility. Like Maxine Waters, basically. Like this is how the week started.
Well, basically, here, let me play. I have the clip. I have a clip. Let's play a bit of the clip, and you can kind of talk us through this, right? This is Maxine Waters at a Families Together's rally, and this is kind of part of what set off the shitstorm this week of all these folks kind of like, oh my, and Chuck and Nancy ending up kind of like censuring like Maxine Waters. This is Maxine Waters speaking at that rally.
If you think we're rallying now, you ain't seen nothing yet. You have members of your cabinet that are being booed out of restaurants. Yeah. Who have protesters taking up at their house. Yeah. Who's saying no peace, no sleep. Yeah. No peace, no sleep. And guess what? We're going to win this battle because while you try and quote the Bible, Jeff Sessions and others, you really don't know the Bible. God is on our side. Yeah. On the side of the children, on the side of what's right, on the side of what's honorable, on the side of understanding that if we can't protect the children, we can't protect anybody.
And that was what set everyone off into a tailspin this week.
Yes. And also, like, right, so like this happens. And then also later on in the week, I guess it was either Monday or Tuesday. It was Monday. Sarah Huckabee Sanders speaks about how the people at the border deserve no judicial due process. People on American soil do not deserve due process. They don't deserve their day in court. We are like rapidly deteriorating into this. Like for some, like the Rubicon was last week with the finally hearing the children screaming and crying inside these detention centers. And the stories coming out inside these detention centers and all the journalism that's going on with these detention centers. Like, I don't know how you can defend or these calls for civility after Monday, after the press conference, when Sarah Huckabee Sanders stood up there for like made a good argument for 15 minutes about why these immigrants deserve no due process. Like think about like we went back to 2000, going back to the Iraq War. There was no due process for the people that we put into the prison sites. And you know, there was no due process for the kill list that Obama had and the drones that we dropped. And that was like overseas and it was all fine and dandy. It wasn't on American soil. Now we are talking about people on American soil that do not have any due process.
That's right. That's right.
And you expect us to be civil about this.
That's right.
Like you expect us not. I mean, like this is like we're watching the deterioration of our democracy happening when we are saying that people don't deserve due process. When you have people on the right wing attacking the media. You know, you had Val DiGiorgio, head of the Pennsylvania Republican Party, saying, you know, stop calling us fascists and Nazis. You know, this is all fake news. There's no families being separated at the border.
Right.
I mean, like you have the Republican lockstep in key on the state levels and on the national levels are goose-stepping ourselves into this like fascistic state that we are like seeing before us. I know this is not hyperbole. Like we are like, you can judge a society by how we treat like our poorest members of like the society, and putting immigrant children in cages is just a future. Like imagine we get these internment camps set up real quickly.
Yeah.
Who's right. to say they're going to stop there? I mean, like anyone who reads history, you know, not going back to like Nazi Germany and stuff like that, but you know, recent history and seeing how we supported these coups in Latin America, especially with Pinochet or like the banana republics or overthrowing, you know, these Democrat governments for fascist states that are friendly towards the United States because in the name of free trade and commerce, like this is like putting people in soccer stadiums.
Yep.
Torture chambers. Like this is not that far from reality.
Yep.
And you have the goal, the balls pretty much to tell us to be civil. Like what hot take should we start with this week? Like out of the shitty ones. Out of the shittiest of the shitty hot takes. Where do you think we should begin?
Let me say something before we get to that because I want to pause for a second on what we're talking about here, because exactly what Sean was working through, and part of what's actually, if I'm going to be reasonable about this, I'm going to be reasonable about it like this. Look, what's happening in my mind, I want to say this as I have long talked about kind of critical civil, like, civility within a classroom, for example, that I teach, right? I talk about the importance of being able to kind of argue effectively to be able and be heated about the arguments, right? Being civil does not necessarily mean being like loving everybody and being nice to everybody. It doesn't mean kumbaya, right? It means that you're agreeing to basically play by a certain kind of set of rules within this. But what happens in these kind of moments is that people kind of conflate, and I think, right, mistake like the ends for the means. And this is what I mean by this, is that I'm going to make a broad and general claim here. I think most of us, and maybe you'll say that I'm wrong about this, everybody, and that's fine. Email me, ragingchickenpress@gmail.com. Let me know. Right. But I think most of us want to live in a society, right, that is not marked by kind of like, you know, constant war. Right. Constant faction. Right. That we can actually go about our lives. Right. Our individual lives, our family lives and our neighborhood and things like this in a way that is civil, that even those folks that we disagree with. Right. That we're going to disagree with them. Sure. Right. But we can also, you know, when we see that they're, you know, across the street, like in our neighbor across the street and they're about to fall off a ladder, we can go over and help them. Right. And not laugh at them. Right. That's kind of like a society where say, OK, look, we're going to disagree about stuff, but we're kind of in this together. Right. And that's this kind of ideal of this kind of civil society. Right. The idea that we play by these rules and we have our differences, we respect the differences, but we argue about them. And then at the end of the day, when we kind of like make a decision, you know, majority, not everybody in. Right. Not consensus. We make a majority decision. Everybody plays by that. Right. Until the next round. OK. So what we have right now is a complete breakdown of that model. And look, good. That model has served the rich, right?
And the far right.
White people, right? The people on top of the social structure for a long period of time. And so much of what has been American history has been about an expansion of that. Say, I want access to that kind of society too as well, right? Black Lives Matter was saying, I don't deserve to be gunned down in the streets. I want to live in a society where the police are there to protect me, not kill me. Right?
For the NFL football players this past year.
Right. This is all this idea about kind of we're moving toward that kind of society. Right. Now, so what happens in moments like this, when there's an actual crisis of the breakdown of the fabric, the social fabric, and you get these calls for kind of civility, those people who are calling for civility, they think in their heads, I think at least, that, oh, the way that you bring about social change is by being civil to one another. And my point is, like, never in history has that been true. Never in history has monumental change happened by people being nice to their oppressors. Never. This is Frederick Douglass, folks. Right? Power cedes nothing without demand. This is the civil rights movement. This is the American Revolution. These are the wars of independence. Right? They have recognized this. This was Tom Paine. And that article I was talking about before that have coming out in Unruly Rhetorics in November, this is exactly one of the things I talk about in that article. Is that what Tom Paine understood, was that, like, no. Unlike his Quaker friends who said, like, hey, just everybody be nice to one another, right? He said, no. I share your ends with you. I share the ends of that kind of civil society where we can actually kind of, like, engage with each other and love each other and kind of be part of one project. But until we sever the bonds, we can't have that. So we are going to bear the sins of the present in order to ensure, right, that everybody can have that going forward. This is one of these moments in American history right now. We have a decision to make about which path that we go, right? And does it mean that we should abandon all kind of like being kind of like kind to one another? Hell no. But when we're talking about, we have a clear, definable enemy, right? The people who are putting kids in cages, the people who are stripping away, right, our social fabric, who are destroying the rights that have been hard fast and hard won over generations, they need to be stopped. And allowing them a nice peaceful dinner at a Mexican restaurant after they just kind of like deported all the Mexicans? I don't know. Maybe you shouldn't get that. Right? That's what we're talking about. Nobody here is arguing for that we should all have a war against all. Nobody is saying that. But we're saying right now, here, right now, power analysis, people, not abstract ideological discussions in the realm of philosophy in the clouds. I'm talking about on the ground where people are actually getting hurt. If we're going to defend this, we have to defend it. And that means those people need to know, those people who are responsible need to be made uncomfortable with their brutality and evil acts. That's all I'm saying. Right? So wait, that's the backdrop. And so when we move in now, Sean and I have got, like, I'm telling you, we've got pages filled with this kind of blather that has been going on Twitter and Facebook and all this kind of stuff, and these defenses of civility. And we're going to get into some of those. But I want to say, I just want to kind of like take that step back for a second, because that's what we're talking about. This is not a game. And maybe in the second part of today's show, maybe at the end of this first segment, I'm not sure yet. Henry Giroux was on Majority Report. Sean was like texting me, man, you got to listen to Henry Giroux on Majority Report today, talking about like fascism and things like this. We get a chance, we'll get to that. And some of the reasons what we need to kind of, I don't know, shake each other. We want to be kind to each other. Let's shake each other and say, this is real. We need to be together. We need to have the courage to stand together to stop this assault on our social fabric. So this past week, after we saw this first explosion at Maxine Waters and then Chuck Schumer's freak out because he's so worried, I guess his main audience is like, oh, I don't know, Fox News, because he's always worried what Fox News is going to say, and that's going to determine what kind of action he's going to have, right? After that, we saw an explosion in social media about, social media. Well, not just social media, like in the real world too, right? These defenses of these calls for civility, right? And so let's take it back to where you were just about to take us, Sean. It's like, where should we start with this one?
I think we should start with my personal favorite.
Oh, please. You're going to make my head blow up again.
Arnie Duncan.
Yeah, okay. I want, Sean, read this slowly for everybody. This is Arnie Duncan. Arnie Duncan, remember, this is Obama's education guy, right? Big voucher guy, big privatization dude, right? Big kind of like metric standardized testing guy who got it out
there. Former Secretary of Education underneath Barack Obama.
Exactly. Out there from Chicago, right? Big friends with Rahm Emanuel, right? Our friend. All right, so he decided to weigh into the debate.
So, oh man, let me read this out, my head exploding. He starts off with the tweet by saying, my personal opinion, colon. no matter how much we dislike or disagree with someone, we should not deny them the chance to have a meal, period. The history in our country of denying people access to restaurants, to water fountains, and even bathrooms is too raw, too real. We can't keep dividing.
I barely even know what to say to that. Let's break this down. Arnie Duncan is saying, right, by having members of the Trump administration have their meals disrupted is the same as Jim Crow and the suppression of African Americans.
400 years of suppression of African Americans and Black and Brown people, and the genocide of Native Americans, and, you know, like Manifest Destiny, and like stealing people's lands and putting them in reservations. You know, like this is.
And what
this is, this, denying Sarah Huckabee Sanders, a privileged white woman who grew up with the daughter of a governor, who had everything handed to her on a silver spoon, you know, her career and everything, keeping her from having a meal, a farm to table meal at a restaurant, is the same as 400 years of repression of Black and Brown people. You know, of Puerto Rico, the thousands, we didn't even talk about this on our podcast yet, but the thousands of people have died after Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. Like, the thousands of people who have died, and yep. Puerto Rico is still without power. This her getting denied a farm-to-table meal is akin to all of that.
Well, and look, and think about what this does, too. Arne Duncan is basically saying, right, the people who will take us back to a time that is like Jim Crow are the people who are disrupting Sarah Huckabee Sanders' meal, right? That's the freaking nut job logic. When that person, Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the Trump administration, they're the ones who are actually passing policies to take us back to that. But the blame gets shifted to the left. And, you know, this is, Sean, I'm telling you. There's this song. Do you know the song "Love Me, Love Me, Love Me"? I'm a liberal.
No,
by
I do
Phil
not.
Oakes. All right. Well, I'm gonna have to pull up some of that sound. This is something. This guy was a folk singer from the 60s and 70s. Right. He was a real kind of lefty, and has got a song all about this. Right. How I've got all the right ideas. You say all the right things. You have all the right affect until it could potentially encroaches upon your gated community or your potential meal. And then maybe this is Arne Duncan having flashbacks to teachers disagreeing with him and protesting some of his policies while he was Secretary of Education. I don't know. But the fact that you would have someone like this that calls himself a Democrat says that it's the activists are the ones who are behaving like Jim Crow, right? Even if you could get past the incredible, I don't even know what to call that.
Mental gymnastics?
Yeah, of conflating, of disrupting Sarah Huckabee Sanders' meal with 400 years of oppression, right? If that's not enough for you right off the top, right? Then you shift the blame to the left and say they are responsible.
The intolerant left.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And so I think we should go next up on the list of civility, because this is a civility debate I got engaged with Monday morning.
Oh, this is a nice one.
Before. So let me preface this by saying I read John Mysick stuff every day. I just to see like a pulse on what's happening here in Harrisburg. And I respect what John does. I think he does some good stuff. And there's also
look at you being so civil. You're so civil.
But there are times where I think he's dead out wrong. So let me just start this. Like, this is March 2016, because I actually remember reading this when John called Donald Trump a fascist. Like, pretty much like he had an article on March 8th, 2016. It said, I only screen grabbed like the top half of it because I didn't screen grab the whole page. But let me just expand this a little bit more so I could read it. Mm-hmm. So it says, Donald Trump's campaign has finally turned the fascist corner. Analysis. And this is during the primary. He said, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has said some pretty controversial stuff since ending the race last June. Consider this litany. He called illegal immigrants rapists and murderers. He called John McCain a war hero, a coward. He suggested banning foreign-born Muslims from entering the country. He's once said he'd like to punch a protester in the face. He's proposed changing libel laws to make it more difficult for reporters to write stories about him. And he said he said he wants to change the law to allow waterboarding and more extreme forms of torture. This is the primary. So fast forward this to Monday, this past Monday. A Harrisburg consultant, which I will explain a little bit more in a couple seconds, Ray Zaborni, who runs Red Maverick, who also married into a wealthy, had the fortune of marrying into a wealthy Republican dynasty within this area, has this consulting group that does nothing but gets right wing nut jobs elected to office. And he said, so this is a tweet that that Zaborni put out. Zaborni is pretty much almost responsible. He's made millions of dollars getting right-wing whack jobs who believe that Barack Obama is a Muslim and who believed in death panels elected to office. Like, this guy's made millions of dollars doing this over the past 8 years. And he said, this is a dangerous place for us to be as a nation. I'm glad I have friends, employees, families, and colleagues that are Democrats. Politics and government are important, but people need to have some grace. It's in short supply, unfortunately, by the extremes on both sides. Now, this is a guy who made millions of dollars getting these fuckers elected to office. And so he goes on to say, so Mike said, quote tweets what Zaborni just said and said that this isn't the right thing to do. Said it before. If you want to have a better country, just rise above those with whom you disagree with. So this is that, like, when they go low, you go high attitude. And I was just like, fuck that. This is literally coming from the side that came into power yelling and screaming and making falsehoods about death panels.
Right.
Please spare me these alligator tears. Like, this is a really crappy hot take. Like, a couple of people jumped in. Andy Hoover was like, no, now is the time for us to do this because there are people's lives on the line. These are people putting in internment camps. These are people like the Carlisle School is like miles away from right here. And the Carlisle School was an experiment back in the 1850s to whiten up the Indian population. And, you know, hundreds of bodies are buried there. It was one of our darkest parts of our history that people seem to forget about. And, you know, like we are doing the same thing with the Carlisle School. We're doing the same things with the Japanese internment camps. And we're calling, and this is just, no, this is bullshit. We shouldn't be calling for civility. We shouldn't be pearl clutching this part.
That's right. And look, this is actually, you know, the seriousness of this is a.
And also I would say that Zaborni's group, the Red Maverick, has been distinguished as one of the best consulting things by Penn Live. So there is like that insider beltway, you know, same social circle strata, like, hey, this guy's in my same social circles. We can't like say anything bad about him because then people like Dennis Owens jumps into this, and Dennis Owens is in that same social strata. You know, this beltway crowd of people like liberals that were no, not even liberals, of elites, political elites, like patting each other on the back. It's like, yes, yes, yes. Everything you say is correct.
Look, you know, this is one of these things where, you know, if you do any activist work, and activists should know this, right? I've had this discussion so many times, I can't even tell you, right? Is that when one of the first, like, I teach a class called Activist Writing Media, I teach another class called Rhetoric and Democracy, right? And one of the things that you always know, right, if you're getting an experience as an activist, is that one of the first charges that will be made against you, right, is that you did not do things in the proper way, the appropriate way, right? So if you do any kind of, you read activist manuals, you go through training sessions and all this stuff, one of the strategies that I think is a good one to start from, again, there's a whole bunch of different ways to do this, but is you try to tick all the boxes. You say, first I went to this person who I'm supposed to go to, and I was denied. Then I went to the next person, and then I was denied. And then I went to the next person. And then I was out of options, and so therefore I decided to shut down your facility, right? You know, something like this, right? You have this escalation of demands, and you kind of go up through these kind of change until you've demonstrated that you've exhausted that change. Now, what happens? Now, that works on a very local level, like, you know, that back and forth. But what always happens, right, is that you'll get these folks that come out of their woodwork, right? And they are more often than not well-meaning, kind of like good-thinking liberals, right, will say, like, look, I agree with what you're arguing for. I just don't agree with how you did it. Right? That is always one of these tricky moments, right, for activists and for people who are moving forward, because they're like, what are you talking about? And then it becomes this debate over what are the appropriate tactics or what you should or you shouldn't say, right? And it diffuses the entire situation, right? Now, if you've done this long enough, right, you know that, like, whatever, you guys are going to say whatever you're going to say and you keep on marching forward. But this is one of these moments, folks. And this is like, you know, when Sean, you know, again, lays out all due respect to John Micek, right? Because he reads his stuff daily and all that kind of stuff. And John Micek, you know, getting singled out, I get it, right? But there's a whole bunch of other people who are doing exactly the same thing in editorial rooms, like, across this country, right? There are tons of academics who are doing this all over the place right now, I guarantee you, right? Who are all want to be civil, right? What you need to kind of take a step back from is you need to look at this as a struggle, a historic struggle of power right now. This is not just about, like, church. This is not your Sunday school manners time, right? That what we need, people who are well-meaning or whatever, is to target these people who are making these decisions that are destroying our society.
Yeah, and let me go back through this list again. Just tick off these. You know, he's called illegal immigrants rapists and murderers. Still doing that today. He's called John McCain a war hero, a coward. His administration is still going after John McCain, even though he's on his deathbed. You know, he suggested banning foreign-born Muslims from entering the country. Well, the Supreme Court just upheld Trump's Muslim ban. Yep. You know, he once said he'd like to punch a protester in the face. He's called for violence repeatedly against demonstrators. He's mocked journalists with disabilities. He's proposed changing libel laws for making it more like this. There's everything that is screaming that this guy wants to be a dictator. And he, like, Micek wants to reason with him. I'm reading Micek's own list that he compiled 2 years ago. And this is who we want to reason with.
Right. Right. I don't know what you do with that. I don't know what you do with it.
There is no reasoning with these people. Fascists don't cede power easily. You don't say, hey, oh, please, would you stop doing that and be more civil? No, they'll fucking steamroll you. This is like standing in front of a mass grave and asking the Gestapo to, like, please, let's be more civil about this as he's about to blow your brains out and put through you in the ditch. Like, yeah. This is like, I mean, like, this is like, you think the Gestapo is going to be civil with you as he's about to throw you in a mass grave with everyone else?
Somehow doesn't seem that would happen, Sean. Something, you know, it's funny, you know,
and I'm gonna be the person standing there and be like, I told you so.
No, right. And look, you know, in some ways, look, these are never easy.
I mean, that is a, like, hyperbolic analogy, but, like, you know, like tossing people out of helicopters was a pretty good tactic that Pinochet used, disappearing people. Like, these are our disappeared people, these kids in these internment camps.
That's right.
And now we're gonna put them on military bases where no one can have access to them.
I'm telling you, man. Look,
we're not going to give them due process. We're not going to give them the right to their day in court.
No, why would we, right? I'm telling you, it's not good, Sean. It's not good. And you know, this stuff makes me so frustrated, because, I mean, I don't know.
And, like, they're worried about someone not being able to eat a meal.
Yes, they are. They are worried about this. You know, I don't know. I'm kind of glad that we're going to have in the next segment, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the victories and then some of the other challenges here, because this is something that I don't know. This explosion,
like,
of
also
this,
talk on, about sorry. Like the destruction of public sector unions. Like, what had, like, every far right wing society, what did they do?
Yep.
They went after the minorities and they destroyed the unions.
Yep. I wonder why. Because they stood up and they fought back. You know, there's this guy, I'll never forget. I studied in Germany for a summer, right? And I stayed with this family in, I was in Jena. This is one part of the trip, is in Jena. And Yaina is in the former East, right? And the guy who I was staying with, and, you know, it was funny because, you know, you don't know what you're going to get and all this kind of stuff. And we're having dinner, and my German was okay, and their English was okay, which was kind of a cool exchange. And, you know, it turned out that he was a faculty member, right? And we got talking over lots of Czech beer one night, right at the table, about what had happened in the later days of the East German government, right, under the Stasi, right. And the night before, we had gone out to dinner with all the other, you know, students who were also studying there and the families that they were staying with, and we on this walk up to this restaurant, it was up this big long hill that you had to walk up to, and as we walk up there, there's this guy and his wife with the students that were staying with him came by, and all of a sudden my family, the one I was staying with, got really quiet and looked at him, looked away, and whatever. And I recognized that. So when we're having our Czech beer discussion that one night, I asked him about that, and it turns out that guy was one of the wealthier people in the kind of the, you know, post East German government, time, right. Prior to unification. And he worked on aerospace stuff. And Yaina was known for producing glass for telescopes and all that kind of stuff. And, he maintained his position, as this scientific position and his status because he collaborated, with the Stasi. And he told me that a lot of his friends, right? He was fired, right? The guy who I was staying with, he was fired from his position as a professor, right? Because he refused to collaborate, because he spoke out against some of the things that were going on. But then he talked about the destruction of some of his colleagues who had decided to try to stick in there and just, you know, we got to keep on skipping to the work and keep our nose to the grindstone and, you know, maintaining the principles of higher education and civic education, and all the while slipping further and further into collaboration. And the devastation on this guy's face just, it haunts me, Sean. And I think about this at the same time. This is one of these moments where, you know, you're in the, especially those folks in the professional class, whether you're academics or whether you're a journalist, whether you're kind of pontificators or whatever you might be, this is your time to stand up and be counted. All right. This is the time where you need to take a stand, right? Defending the institution of higher education, defending the institution of journalism, defending the institution of civil society requires discomfort right now. It requires you to stand up and fight back against this stuff, right? And hiding behind the cloak of civility is not going to do it. It's not going to do it. I don't know. Maybe I'm off base, Sean. I don't know.
Yeah.
Any other good tweets from this week?
Just a bunch of ones calling the civility argument bullshit. Which is what we should be doing.
Yep, we should. Uh-oh. Sorry. Oh, here we go. I had a, you know, it's funny because I grew up a good punk rocker, you know. And do you ever hear the band Crass?
No.
No. Or Crass was one of the kind of the more kind of radical punk bands that I would listen to. And, you know, it seems to me that in this moment, when we're talking about civility, collaboration, all this kind of stuff, that it would be fitting as we go into break to hear a little bit, of Crass, if it will load in time. But so there's I'm sure if you saw the symbol, you'd kind of recognize it. You'd be like, well, what was that? What was that kind of punk rocker thing? But I don't know. I don't know. You know, one of the things that I would say as we're kind of getting ready to go in the next break, after the break, we want to talk a little bit about some of the amazing victories from last night in the New York primary, in the Maryland primary. There's some other ones too as well, and then we got to get into some of the stuff around the Supreme Court, because the stuff around the Supreme Court is going to have significant effects. And just like we said in the intro about you know, elections have consequences. Well, this is one of the big ones, the fact that we're going to have the Supreme Court. stood behind the Trump travel ban. And it was Sonia Sotomayor's dissent in that case was absolutely scathing. But we have to remember what that means, right? That might, her scathing dissent is important. And she stood up and she was counted, certainly on this one. But at the same time, that decision now holds. And then we're going to have the Supreme Court decision on Janus, and we're going to talk about what that means too as well. Anyways, my little soundboard thing here is not I'm not cooperating here, so I'm just going to kind of want to go into break. Sean, anything else before we head into break?
I think I said what needs to be said.
You can just be said. All right. All right, we'll see if I can get this to go. I'm just going to have to keep on talking here, folks, because our soundboard seems to have locked up. So just give me one second here, and then we're going to get it. And I think I need this. All right. So welcome to this is Crass, and this is Shaved Women from 1979. This will take us into break. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this.
Shaved Women Collaborator!
Train tracks, if you can't hear it.
Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1905. That was the day over 200 socialists, anarchists, and Marxists representing over 40 organizations met at Brands Hall in Chicago to convene the founding of the Industrial Workers of the World. Representatives from groups like the Socialist Party, Socialist Labor Party, and Western Federation of Miners joined together for an 11-day convention to discuss the future of industrial unionism and revolutionary struggle. Those present included Big Bill Haywood, James Connolly, Daniel De Leon, Eugene V. Debs, Lucy Gonzalez Parsons, Mother Jones, and many more. They hoped to cohere an alternative to the politically conservative business unionism of the American Federation of Labor. They sought to build on the legacy of the Knights of Labor and their motto of "an injury to one is an injury to all." They were determined to build an industrial union that organized workers regardless of skill level. They also distinguished themselves by opening their doors to men and women, black, white, and all immigrant workers, including Asians. Big Bill Haywood opened the first day's morning session with the following remarks, saying, quote, "This is the Continental Congress of the Working Class. We are here to confederate the workers of this country into a working class movement that shall have as its purpose the emancipation of the working class from the slave bondage of capitalism. There is no organization that has for its purpose the same object as that for which you are called together today. The aims and objects of this organization should be to put the working class in possession of the economic power, the means of life, in control of the machinery of production and distribution without regard to capitalist masters." For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. And Sean, given the amazing Supreme Court rulings this week, all I got to say is Jill Stein 2020.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be interviewing for that campaign, I guess, in 2019 at some point.
Yeah.
You know, just bringing the world leftward, I guess.
Yep. Sorry, all of you folks out there. Sorry to twist the knife a little bit on this one, but it is one of those weeks. But let's talk about, before we get into the Supreme Court, the devastation, let's talk about the amazing, amazing victories last night, especially. I think the water. This is potentially one of these watershed moments, right? And the way that what we saw in Pennsylvania had reverberations around the country. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's defeat of Joe Crowley in the New York 17th House District. Boom! Holy Sean.
Yeah, it was the 14th District.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did I say?
17th.
Oh, my fault. Sorry.
But there were some more progressive victories last night. But I mean, anyone who was watching this race with Ocasio-Cortez should not be surprised that she blew Crowley out of the water. You could just tell by Crowley's body language and the way he's been doing things the past few weeks. He knew he was going to get smoked.
Yeah.
I mean, there was just no way to put it out there. I mean, I am not surprised that she won because I've been calling it for a few weeks that she was going to win. But I mean, like, it's the type of thing where people, you know, I put a tweet up last night. You know, like, people laughed at me when I said that, that you know, Fiedler and Imerato and Summer Lee were all going to win their victories in Pennsylvania, these primaries, that the union officials said that they should not, these women should not even be running in, because now these unions are going to spend money defending incumbents that they were running against, and where that money could have gone elsewhere in the general elections. And, you know, we talked about that with our interview on our podcast. And I mean, like, we were saying this since February that these three women had a shot at winning, and they were probably going to win just because the groundswell that was going on. And you could see the same thing happening with Ocasio-Cortez. I think you look at Crowley's demeanor over the past weeks, he knew he was going to get smoked.
Well, what was interesting about this shows you exactly, you know, I tweeted out earlier today, it's like, you know, okay, hey, labor movement, you know, let's put that final nail in the coffin of business unionism right now, right? And machine politics for exactly this reason. I mean, you saw a degree of kind of, you know, like, removed from his constituency and a certain kind of false confidence in the position of that, you know, machine politics, which was just decimated. I mean, this was the Democratic Party's kind of belief for a long time now that it's all about the money. Right. And he was one of their best. Joe Crowley was one of the Democratic Party's best
fundraisers.
And that went down. Like, his $3 million against Ocasio-Cortez's, I think, about $600,000 is what she raised. But, like, an absolute army of grassroots activists and kind of doing the work in the community. It was amazing to behold. And the fact is that she had no apologies. She didn't soft walk, right, progressive politics or left politics. She was out there for, like, you know, universal health care, right?
Federal guaranteed jobs programs.
Free college tuition, right? The end of ICE, right? And and that was what she ran on. She didn't walk away from it. And you had Crowley actually, you know, kept on trying to kind of, you know, do the Clinton thing, right? It was like, we used to do this to Republicans. Now I guess I got to do that to the left. We're going to take on some of the language of progressive politics in order to try to bring over some of those voters. Voters weren't buying it. Right. And, you know, he kept on saying, he's like, the people of Queens, they know me. Well, they did, Joe. They did. Right. And they know that. Yeah. Look, the guy didn't have horrible politics. Right. It wasn't as if this was like a anti-immigrant immigrant Democrat like we saw out here in Pennsylvania. Right. What this was a guy who was part of a machine about the way that you do politics. And it was money-driven, consultant-driven, top-down kind of politics. And what we see here with Ocasio-Cortez is a grassroots mass mobilization from the left. And she didn't just win. She won handily.
Yes, and it shows you what happens when people are organized with a campaign. You look at some of the stuff that's going on out here. I mean, the three women that one mentioned earlier, they had ground games. They were taking on incumbents who haven't been challenged in 15 years, 20 years, who maybe only had one or two challengers their whole entire career. But, like, it wasn't that they were just challenged. It was that they had the backing of the Democratic Socialists of America. They had the backing of these progressive left, far left progressive coalitions. And they won on that. I mean, they knocked doors. I mean, when I saw that ad, that 2-minute ad that she put up a few weeks ago about what my district really looks like,
Well, remember, yeah, because I remember when I sent that out, and we actually used that audio from that ad, right, in our podcast that week, like, after that was released, because it was so freaking amazing.
Yes. I mean, like, this is what, I mean, I feel like that they're going to do everything they can to make sure she's a one-term incumbent, a one-term congresswoman, the Democratic Party, because they're going to try to resist this change. But it shows you that the left, someone tweeted at me that, like, entryism politics works. And the idea of, like, entryism is you have an organization like the DSA. They run as Democrats in primaries who are socialists. They're proud to be called socialists. They win. And now they're going to drag the Democratic Party to the left.
Yeah,
we've been seeing it happen in local races. We're seeing it happening, like, in ward leaderships. We're seeing this happen all across the country. You know, it's not happening, like, everywhere, but it's happening to the point where people can't ignore the fact that that this is going to happen. Like, in Pennsylvania, there's going to be three DSA endorsed women. A couple of them are actual members. They're going to become in office. There's two more endorsed DSA candidates, actual members, that are running in Kristen Seal, mm-hmm, and in Delaware County,
right,
and Mike Doyle in Northeast Philly. And everyone's like, you can't be running on that. You're in Northeast Philadelphia. You can't be running as a socialist in Northeast Philly. Yes, you can. You could be running as a socialist in southeastern Pennsylvania and still win, you know, and take out these Republicans and really, like, start to have a hold. And that is the only way our politics is going to change.
Well, and it's exactly what it's like when you say you can't run as a socialist on these things. Like, what that means has so fundamentally changed over the past few years. I mean, since the Bernie Sanders campaign, really, that we've brought these ideas, right, back into our political discourse. The idea that, like, socialist doesn't mean that you're sitting out there and kind of trying to convert everybody to Marx, right? That's not, like, that if that's your vision of what socialism is, whatever, dude.
Like, right? I've never read Marx. Like, I've read, like, it is, like, I just never, I guess it's, like, intellectual laziness, but I've read, like, excerpts of Marx. But, you know, I've been calling myself a socialist since I was in high school. And it's not because, like, I believe in, like, you know, the seizing of private property and, you know, full-blown Marxism or communism. No. I want a European-style socialism where we have it's socialism today. It was they were called New Deal Democrats 50, 60, 80 years ago, 70 years ago, when the Depression happened. These are the programs that we should be having, and these are the programs that they're fighting for. Why are we the only country in the world without free public higher education, without health care for all? I mean, we're the only country in the world where you get sick, it could devastate your wealth and throw you in debt for generations.
Yep.
And this is what they're fighting against. Basic human decency is what they want.
Yeah, and you know what you've got that as kind of as your baseline, right? And then also, I think the important part of the conversation is that has been expanded, right? Of our political discourse that has been expanded over the past few years has also been about what our role in this, our world is, right? I mean, what our role in our society is. And the idea is that, you know what? Is that we should be making policy. We shouldn't just be choosing from bad choices that other people decide. Right. You know, what you see, for example, like the Me Too movement, for example, right, is that all these women who came forward and said, you know what, yeah, enough of this. Right. Oh, and by the way, right, enough of this. And we're not just going to hope and lobby you to make the right choices. Yes, we're going to do that. But then what we're going to do is we're going to run for office so that we can begin taking control and making those choices. Right. And expanding the way that our discourse is, expanding our options that are out there. Right. And this is what I've always said is, like, you know, we talk about being, like, democratic and all this stuff. And yet, you know, we accept most of our lives. Right. Most of our lives are spent at work, which is, for the most part, extraordinarily undemocratic area. Right. The whole idea that we start asking even questions about what kind of input should we have? Right. What kind of control should we have in our everyday lives? Right. Not just in the halls of government, but also in our workplaces, also in our communities. Right. That's an amazing and fruitful kind of, like, rediscovery, I think, in our politics. So, you know, and it's all credit is for those folks, those activists, those young folks, really, who have been pushing this and are saying, okay, look, enough of this old tired discourse, right? Enough of this passing of the baton from one old white person to the next old white person, right? Ocasio-Cortez did it in one of the interviews. I think it was one she did with, I don't know who did, but she goes, she basically said, is like, you know, what does it mean that, like, everyone is saying, oh my God, you know, Joe Cortez, he was like in line to become the next Speaker of the House when Nancy Pelosi handed it over, but he said he wouldn't run against her. He's going to wait his turn, right? And she's like, what kind of crazy world is that? Right. So you have one person who's like in her 70s or something like this, or late 60s, 70s. You're going to hand it on to someone else who's in his early 60s, right there, who's just kind of been part of that same machine. And that's how we do this. It's not about your policies. It's not about your vision. It's not about where you want to take the party. It's about waiting your turn. Really? And these folks are coming and saying, nope, we're not playing those games anymore.
And you know what?
New vision.
You know who should be really scared after last night?
Do tell.
Cuomo.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm really interested to see what's going to happen with that,
because like I'm pretty sure he might be looking at that as a warning sign of what's coming down in a few months.
Yeah, maybe. Although, you know, Cynthia Nixon has been, you know, she's you know, like the fact that she waited to, like, I don't know, like an hour before the primary or something like this to endorse Ocasio-Cortez. Right. She's playing certain kind of cards there. She did kind of appear with her and kind of congratulate her and things like this. And by the way, I think there's some folks that are a little bit skeptical about her thing. But, you know, she's got a good background of activists and stuff like this. But, you know, I don't know. When it comes right down to it, I think what Ocasio-Cortez's victory basically, you know, you always talk about moves the Overton window. Right. Suddenly start people seeing possibilities and say, hey, wait a minute. If she actually beat Crowley, maybe, you know, Cuomo isn't like the preordained next, you know, continue. Maybe he's actually vulnerable. Maybe he's not as kind of entrenched as we think he is. We'll see.
Yeah. And then I guess it was, I will say this real quick. It was funny. I watched MSNBC for like a half an hour before I went on today. And the full freakout mode is just like, is in full swing about Ocasio-Cortez and how she's just promising, going free, 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 free. You can't guarantee free, 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 free. You're not going to pay for it. It's a lie. You know, it is like, it's Steve Schmidt called dishonest progressivism and stuff like that. And it's just like, no, we can pay for this. We just choose not to.
Yep.
Like, I mean, like, and that's where people, like, the argument's going to change.
Well, exactly. There's, I mean, look, we'll say, well, look, how do you pay for this stuff? And this is, you know, this is one thing that Bernie Sanders helped define. This is like, well, you just spent what, $1 trillion on handing money over to rich people for doing nothing other than being rich. Right. That helped what? A fraction of a percent of people.
400 families.
Exactly. Right. While as you can actually have universal health care or free college tuition or one of these things with the same amount of money. Right. This is about will. This has nothing to do with, like, you know, we're broke. Right. If anything, like, that whole narrative is beginning to crumble. Right. People are seeing that this is, you're not broke. You just freaking are handing over checks.
Yeah.
Right. To the people who already got everything that they want.
And then, you know, there's another huge victory last night.
Yeah. Ben Jealous, man. Ben Jealous in Maryland.
I will be honest. I did not even realize he was running for governor of Maryland until last night. I heard Ben Jealous is going to be. Got the nomination, which is, again, someone, you know,
Sean's like that's because Sean has got like one of those electric collars on. When he hits the borders of Pennsylvania, it shocks him and he has to come back. Just kidding.
Like, I mean,
Sean, I wish everybody could see Sean's face right now. He's like, you bastard.
But no, I mean, like, Ben Jealous is someone, what, the former head of the NAACP?
Yes.
And who's been, I mean, he knows that inside outside game really well, and but no, he's, again, this is a key progressive victory.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, it was a fairly crowded field, too, as well. And then the fact that Ben Jealous and Sean and I were talking a little bit about this before the show, too, what Sean was mentioning there about the inside outside game is that one of the things that's interesting about what he brings to the table. There was a great piece in These Times this week, which is linked in the show notes today. Talk about, look, what Ben Jealous is bringing forward as kind of his campaign is not just a platform of issues. These are the things, these are the platitudes, but he's got some detailed plans about how you actually change what's going on. And say, for example, in policing, right, or in our prison system, or in, you know, X, Y, and Z. And because he's been operating in that, but has kind of like, I don't know, has continued to kind of move and become more open about how progressive he is. He's been really interesting character to watch, is that he's actually in a like in a position to take on a certain kind of leadership role in terms of helping other people kind of define policy stuff, kind of know the ropes a little bit. So the fact that you've got someone who's got those kind of credentials is actually you know, won that primary and has a real strong shot at the governor's office this fall is incredible. Now, the Republican governor of Maryland has a fairly high approval ratings right now, so it's going to be an interesting contest when it comes in the fall. But this is another huge, huge victory. So that's another race to watch as we get into the 2018 midterms. Crazy. Yeah. So I guess to go back down the other end of the roller coaster here, the two big Supreme Court, we've already kind of talked a little bit about
all
this stuff.
All three include the abortion centers.
Oh, yeah. Three. Right. So three big Supreme Court rulings. Was that this week or was that last
week?
Yes. Oh, my God. See, I can't.
The decimation of the left.
So as we've got these, you know, these huge successes that are going on, and that brings us back to the whole kind of civility thing about these people are taking this stuff away. The Supreme Court upheld Trump's Muslim ban. Right. And, you know, this is, you know, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, this is basically a return to like Plessy versus Ferguson. This is a return to the same kind of logic that we saw that justified the Japanese internment camps. It's pretty incredible. There's a really good article in Vox by Aziz Huq. I hope I got the last name. H-U-Q is the last name. And it's called The Travel Ban Decision Echoes Some of the Worst Supreme Court Decisions in U.S. History. And basically what so it says, three times in American history, the Supreme Court has been asked to speak to a law neutral on its face, yet rooted in a popular hatred or intolerance of minorities. Three times it has chosen to ignore the real reasons for the law. Three times it has instead given a free pass to laws and policies predicated on discriminatory judgments that our Constitution supposedly bars. And then kind of proceeds to talk about Plessy versus Ferguson and Korematsu versus the United States, which is the one that ended up justifying the internment camps. Right. The third case, the one that was just ruled on this week, was Hawaii versus Trump, which basically was pushing back against the travel ban. Here's the problem, right? Let me just go read a bit of this. So it's basically saying, hey, look, there's the president doesn't, or the policy itself doesn't say we're doing this because we're discriminating against religion, right? It's doing it in the realm of, it's because of national security, right? So it says the Supreme Court's new test means surrendering its independent judgment on national security issues. And if that's true, the courts are toothless as a check on discrimination. Court challenges then are kabuki theater, not a quest for compliance with best ideals. Notably, and this basically would justify kind of Japanese, the same thing, the same logic would justify Japanese internment, because it basically echoes the same kind of worst logic that we're seeing in the Korematsu versus the United States decision. Right, this is a big deal, right? Not only because it justifies the Muslim ban. Right. But what this article, and if you read this kind of opinion and some of the commentary in the opinion, go to SCOTUSblog.com. That's a great source for this stuff, too, as well, is that it is potentially expansive because it basically says if the administration, right, if the executive branch is making a decision based upon national security issues, right, as long as it doesn't say, just the words don't come out of its mouth that says we are interning these people because they're Mexican. Right. Then and says that we're doing this because we're trying to protect America's borders and keep America safe, then all is possible. Right? This is not good. Right? So that happens here. Why don't you take us into the kind of the abortion stuff this week, Sean?
Basically, the Supreme Court legitimized the opinion that crisis pregnancy centers have the right to hand out fake information on abortions and stuff like that.
Not good. So disinformation is now protected by the U.S. Supreme Court and the Constitution. How about that?
Yes.
How about that? Right. Well, and the other big one, of course, is Janice versus AFSCME. Now, we've talked about that extensively on this show. You know, if you're anywhere even close to labor folks, especially in the public sector, you know what Janice is. But it's done. So,
Janice, and there's one thing.
Go ahead.
Okay, so there's one thing I have to say about this. Yeah. Because I got an argument blew up on my Facebook feed about this last week. Labor unions and the AFL-CIO have no right endorsing shitty Republicans anymore from here on out. You know, even if they've been lifelong union supporters, they have no right in supporting people like John Rafferty, who shared the stage with Donald Trump in the 2016 primary and endorsed him. Rafferty is a conservative Republican who is friendly with like the building trades, but he has made inflammatory statements against immigrants. He's going after women's rights to choose. These people should not have endorsements from any labor unions because they do not represent the new American majority of women, women of color, and, you know, people of color, which are the largest growing demographics in unions right now.
Yep.
And these endorsements are probably because they're good on issues like prevailing wage and building trade stuff and workers' comp, not on the big union, one big union picture.
Right. It basically says, you know, these specific workers, not workers. Right. And that's really the difference. Is that, you know, that's the difference between a machine politics approach, that's a business unionism approach, that's kind of like dealing behind the scenes instead of advocating for what is right, instead of advocating for what kind of should be for all workers, right? You're going to split certain segments of the working class off from everyone else, right? And give them some goodies, right? And that's going to be enough, right? And as long as I got mine, screw the rest of you, right? That's done, folks. That's done. You know, this is the kind of thing is like, you know, again, I'll go back to what Brett Banditelli said when we were talking about Sarah Enamorato, right, and Summer Lee's victories out there in Pittsburgh. And we were talking about how Dom Costa, right, who was, again, running against or was the incumbent that Sarah Enamorato was running against. Dom Costa had supported legislation that had been kind of like tough on immigrants. Right. And Brett Banditelli, you know, tweeted out like, I will never understand people who say that they are supportive of the labor movement don't see immigrants as workers, right? Because look at all the work that they're doing. And so, again, you open the tent, you are either of the working class and for the working class, right, of labor, right, or you're part of the problem at this point, right? So, I mean, a lot's going to happen here. Right. A lot's going to happen. And I know that, look, labor organizations, one, they may publicly be saying that they are very, you know, look, we're going to keep on going and blah, 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 blah. I get that. I know for a fact that they're scared out of their minds of what's going to happen. Because, look, here's a perfect example. So who is going to be affected by this? It's not just AFSCME. It's not just government workers. Right. All teachers who work in public schools are now going to be affected by this. Right. All faculty like myself, right, who are part of a union are going to be affected and work for a public university are going to be affected by this. Right. All the people who, for example, at my university, right, who are not part of my union, but SCUPA, right, are kind of professional unions. Right. They're going to be affected by this. And one of the things that happened in Pennsylvania when we saw just the last election, we saw that there was about 45%. 40%, depending on which union, depending on what you're saying. And some unions we have are as high as 45% voted for Trump. Right. And they've bought into, they belong to the union simply because like, hey, look, it's going to be, it's going to be to their benefit and so on. Now, basically what Janice tells those people, it basically says, yeah. Remember how you would pay these dues and you did, well, guess what? You get to have all the benefits of a union contract and you don't have to pay anything for it. That's what this decision says. So it's not like, okay, I don't want to be a member of the union, so therefore I'm on my own. No. You still get the benefits of the union contract. It's disgusting. And I guarantee you, you're going to see a significant drop off. That's what happened in Madison. That's what happened. I'm not Madison. What's happened in Wisconsin after they kind of went right to work in Wisconsin? Huge drop off.
And we should also talk about the people who pushed us, especially here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, please do.
People like Matt Briere from the Commonwealth Foundation, the Fairness Center, the Americans for Fair Treatment. You know, these are dark money groups that have billionaire class in Pennsylvania, the Scaife family, the Koch brothers, all this dark money stuff. This is who's been doing it.
Yep.
And we've been saying it for years.
Yep.
I don't think we have to elaborate much more. I mean, like, it's the usual band of suspects. And, you know, going back to these Republicans that are getting union endorsements over an AFT organizer, a Democrat running as an AFT organizer outside in the Northeast Philly or outside the Philadelphia suburbs. His opponent got the union endorsements from the AFL-CIO because he's been a longtime supporter of labor and not the person working to organize teachers.
How about that?
Yeah.
Here's a couple suggestions right now at Kutztown, locally at Kutztown. We've been on this tip for a while now, about a different model of organizing. And I'll be honest. It's been fits and starts. Right. And actually trying to kind of build an engaged membership. But, you know, one of the things that we passed around as we're getting ready for preparing for our first ever strike back in 2016 is that I bought a bunch of copies of Jane McAlevey's No Shortcuts. Right. And passed them out to some of the organizers and folks are here. And I all my union brothers and sisters are out there. This is the book to pick up and read. Right. It's, you know, she has been an organizer on the front lines. For like several decades now. She worked for SEIU and so on. And this book, No Shortcuts, is just absolutely fantastic. Now, one of the things why this book is so important is because McAlevey actually has real world experience organizing workers in right to work states and winning. Right. And again, it's not like, you know, some magic pixie dust, right? There's a tried and true method of organizing that is about membership mobilization and organizing and empowerment. It's not about, you know, are you able to get access to this particular politician who then can make you a particular promise? No, no, no. It's like saying all power comes from membership involvement and membership engagement and an active militant union, right? So that's tip number one, Jane McAlevey, No Shortcuts. Tip number two is pick up a subscription to Labor Notes. Labor Notes has been around, God, as long as I've been politically, like, you know, conscious. And they have been basically the voice of, like, radically democratic militant labor organizing, right? Member-driven organizing, ground-up organizing, right? And they have been, you know, I'll never forget watching members of Labor Notes, of some of the organizers of Labor Notes, being shunned by some of the national labor leaders because they so vehemently disagreed with them. Especially when you saw Teamsters for a Democratic Union, which got a lot of kind of movement back in the 80s or 90s. And Labor Notes was very kind of followed that very closely. Those folks who are arguing for democratic member-controlled unions, that are ground-up mobilization, that the leadership has to do with the members' demand and that power flows from the members forward. Labor Notes has been that place where we see this discussed. So subscribe to Labor Notes. They need to be supported more than ever for exactly that reason. And here would be my tip, right? If there's people out there who've got some extra cash, contact Labor Notes, right? And get, you know, say, hey, look, can we work out a deal that I can get 10 copies or 15 copies for my local organizers and things like this that I can pass around and do that. Those folks are where it's at. So those are my tips for the week, Sean.
Yeah.
So, man. So anything else for the good of the order for this segment?
I'm kind of spent from the first half.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny because I was kind of spent actually when we started today because, we talked about so much before we went on, and I was like, holy crap, what it is. All right, so what we're going to do is we're gonna take a little break here. And I don't know. I have such mixed feelings today because, like, there's so much stuff that is so serious. And at the same time, I'm elated at what we just saw in these primaries yesterday. It's a real weird feeling, I got to say, everybody. So, all right. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. When we come back, we're going to have the last call, and we have no idea what we're going to talk about.
This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 6 years, we've brought unapologetic, progressive, activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive, independent media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting, investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. After the Trump election, we dug in even deeper. Thanks to some longtime members, one-time donations, and a shift in other resources, we brought on more writers and started paying them. Now we're doubling down and want to expand our infrastructure and pay our writers even more. We need to invest in our media if we have a chance to resist the unprecedented assault on democracy, working families, women's rights, and our planet. History will remember the choices we make today. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a local craft beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways that you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive, activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support. Keep up the fight.
Welcome back to Raging Chickens. Out the Coop podcast, last call, and we have nothing to talk about today. Not really, but Sean, man, anything good going on this week? Now that the end of
I started shooting pool this week for the first time in like years.
Awesome.
It was something that I was pretty terrible at in college. Like I could never hit the cue ball correctly. Uh-huh. But one of the guys, like one of the teachers, former teacher I hang out with at the bar, said, "Hey, you want to play some pool?" I'm like, "Okay, why not?" I was like, "I haven't done it in years, but I actually did fairly well. I won one round versus like out of four."
Nice. Hey, it's something.
But I mean, like I was like able to like make shots and, you know, like difference between like the key is like hitting the ball softly, not hard. Like
exactly.
Yeah. Like, so, getting the angles down properly, made some fun shots. And, we played eight ball and then, Free Will, Craigle was on tap.
Nice.
At the bar.
It's a great beer. That's a great
beer. One of my favorite IPAs. It's actually a really good IPA. I was at Millworks in Harrisburg, which is a nice little brew pub, farm to table type place. It's part of the revitalization of Midtown. They've done a lot working hand in hand with the farmers market that's right next to it, the Broad Street Market, making sure that runs correctly. And in order for like the Millworks to be successful, the Broad Street Market to be successful, they both have to have a symbiotic relationship. They have a nice brewery in there. The beers are actually pretty nice, and it also serves as an art space. They have like 20 different art galleries in it. It was an old textile mill that they converted into the space, and it's been like a nice housing for like the art, the arts in Harrisburg and Midtown.
Nice, man. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I went by, I was actually at Free Will yesterday. I got for Father's Day, my brother-in-law gave me a gift certificate or a gift card for Free Will. So I went over there and kind of like spent it all. And I picked up a six pack of Craigle. Craigle, when it comes out, if you get the cans, right, it comes out, it's 12-ounce cans instead of the 16-ounce cans. But it's great. It is like Sean was saying, it's a great kind of summer drinking beer. So I picked up both the Craigle and Lord Business, right? Which, by the way, I don't know if you saw that last night. I was like, I said I was I opened up a can of Lord Business last night, which I love that beer anyways. But I was like, I'm drinking this in honor, right, of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's victory over Joe Crowley, the fourth most powerful Democrat, corporate Democrat in the House. And I am going to, like, disappear, or where I'm going to kind of, like, get rid of this Lord Business, right, in her honor, right, too, as well. So that was a nice way to celebrate last night. But, yeah, so Free Will's got a bunch of stuff out there. They've got a new cherry sour that I picked up. I have not had it yet. I don't know what it's like. But they've got some stuff in the works, but they're really stocked up for, like, good summertime fun. So if you're actually kind of looking for stuff to do 4th of July and that kind of stuff, they got pick up 6-packs of Kregel. They got Micromanager in 6-packs. Again, the 12-ounce ones. Great, two excellent light drinking beers. Looking for something to do over the weekend. They got their full schedule out this week. And since we're coming to you on Wednesday, I'll give you the full schedule. Tomorrow, that's Thursday, there's going to be beer, and the food truck is going to be Stuffed and Twisted Pretzels. That will start at 5, right? Also, Friday, there'll be beer and tray locally sourced. Saturday, the Meat Wagon Barbecue will be the food truck, and Free Will will also be at the Perkasie Farmers Market from 9 to 12 p.m. And on Sunday, in addition to the fabulous beer, the Smoke Factory Barbecue will be on hand to give you all your wonderful eats. So that's pretty cool. You know, I've been thinking about a lot of there's some places that I want to visit pretty soon, hopefully. There's I know. I can't believe I forgot to mention this in previously. So I guess I got to mention it now. So this Saturday, right, is the Keep the Families Together rallies around the country. Right. So
there's one in Harrisburg.
Yes.
12 o'clock on the steps. I'll be there.
Yep. There's mass organizing that's going on all over the place. I know there's one right by me. There's one in Doylestown. There's one in Philadelphia. I may be away, like up the mountains this weekend. So I've checked it out. There's one in Wilkes-Barre. So if there's anybody out there in Wilkes-Barre who listens to this podcast, just drop me a line at ragingchickenpress@gmail.com and let me know you're going to be there, or kind of shoot me a message on Facebook, because I'm going to actually be there. If we end up going up there, I will be at the Wilkes-Barre rally. If not, I'll be at the one in Doylestown, most likely, either way. So that's going to be happening this weekend. It'll be very cool. And when I'm up there, going to check out hopefully some breweries up there. I like to always swing by North Slope, which is in Dallas, who has got fabulous food and some good summer drinking beers and that kind of stuff. Getting into that mode. So I don't know. Whew, Sean, I'm tired, man. I'm tired now.
Yeah.
I didn't expect to be this. I didn't expect that to exhaust me so much, I guess what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, looks like we got some World Cup news.
So World Cup news. Do tell.
Germany is out.
Whoa.
And Mexico is in.
Mexico is in. Yep. Got that, Donnie? Got that, Trumpsters? Mexico is in. Got it. Well, I have to say, I'll use that as an opportunity. You know, my daughter is playing soccer. Right. And it's the first time that, you know, she's played, you know, kind of like these with smaller kids. But this is the first year that she's actually, I don't know, she's just taken to it. Right. I mean, it's incredible watching her. I have one of her games tonight, and she's loving it, and she's actually really good. I'm like, holy crap. It's so fun to watch her. And so it's the fact that the World Cup is going on right now is all the better. I wish it was Women's World Cup so she could see kind of women playing, because she's always asking about that. But it's been kind of a cool context that the World Cup's going on and she started playing soccer, and we get to kind of share those moments together. So
one last thing I'd like to say.
Yeah.
The officer who
shot
and killed Antoine Rose was charged with criminal homicide today. They will decide which murder charge it should be. Stephen Zappala said it could be as low as – it's definitely going to be a murder 3, but he said it could be as high as a first-degree murder. At the press conference this morning while we were recording, a tweet went out from someone in the media. Said the DA spokesperson says – and this is in reference to disputed media reports that were out, putting out false information from cops who were trying to blackball this investigation, lowball it, basically said, you failed. You continuously fed the community information that was wrong. And this is what the district attorney spokesperson said to people, to the media members. And Someone in the room said there was people who are also there. They start clapping once they dress down KDKA and WPXI for their false reportings.
Well, there you have it. Just never stops, folks. Never stops. All right. I think we should call it quits, Sean. What do you call you?
Yeah, I think so.
You got anything planned for the rest of the day?
No. Just looking forward to some things I got planned later on this week.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe someday we'll be able to tell you about it, everybody. All right. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Thanks for sticking with us today for the special fuck civility kind of episode, which turned out to be surprisingly exhausting in ways that I did not expect, I have to say. But now I'm just going to about to kind of basically take in as much news as I possibly can get about the Supreme Court decisions that have come down and kind of where we are now thinking about what happens next. We're going to have a lot more for you. In the coming week. So remember, everybody, if you can become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month, just go to patreon.com/RC press and become a member today. We need you now more than ever. If you are someone who wants to write for Raging Chicken Press, now is the time to get in touch with me. Because the 2018 midterms are coming up fast. I'm telling you what's going to start happening on the ground, especially when it comes in the wake of this Janus decision and the other Supreme Court decisions that happened this week. Things are going to ramp up quite significantly when it comes to on-the-ground activism. So we need some people to cover them. So contact me, RagingChickenPress@gmail.com or editor@RagingChickenPress.org, and hope to hear from you. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We will be back with you. Who knows? Wednesday? No. Thursday? Friday? Saturday? Who knows? See ya!
For 20 years, our rents have been going up, healthcare's been getting more expensive, and our incomes are staying the same. Not all Democrats are the same, and I am proud to be the only Democrat in this race that rejects all corporate money and champions and advances improved and expanded Medicare for all, a federal jobs guarantee, tuition-free public college, and the abolition of ICE. Now, I am proud to have inspired many of adaptations in this race, but what I think is really important is that in a district that is 85% Democrat, overwhelmingly working class, and 70% people of color, we deserve a working class champion.